This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and we begin today in Helsinki.
Thank you. I have just concluded a meeting with President Putin on a wide range of critical issues for both of our countries. We had direct, open, deeply productive dialogue. Went very well.
President Donald Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin stood side by side for the first time at a press conference after a two-hour private meeting between the two world leaders.
Negotiations with the President of the United States, Donald Trump, took place in a frank and business-like atmosphere. I think we can call it a success and a very fruitful round of negotiations.
President Trump and President Putin said they talked about many issues, including Syria, Crimea, and Russian interference in U.S. elections.
During today's meeting, I addressed directly with President Putin the issue of Russian interference in our elections. I felt this was a message best delivered in person. Spent a great deal of time talking about it.
Once again, President Trump mentioned the issue of the so-called interference of Russia in the American elections.
The main thing, and we discussed this also, is zero collusion, and it has had a negative impact upon the relationship of the two largest nuclear powers.
I had to reiterate things I said several times, including during our personal contacts, that the Russian state has never interfered and is not going to interfere into internal American affairs, including election process.
I think that the probe is a disaster for our country. I think it's kept us apart.
The summit came at the end of a heated trip across Europe and the UK for Donald Trump. On Sunday, he called the European Union a foe. But the takeaway from Helsinki, so far, President Trump has put on a warm, friendly front next to Putin, a former KGB agent, and it was so warm, in fact, that my jaw hit the floor.
Our meeting carries on a long tradition of diplomacy between Russia, the United States, for the greater good of all. And this was a very constructive day. This was a very constructive few hours that we spent together. It's in the interest of both of our countries to continue our conversation, and we have agreed to do so. I'm sure we'll be meeting again in the future, often, and hopefully we will solve every one of the problems that we discussed today. So, again, President Putin, thank you very much.
As President Trump mentioned, the meeting took place while here in the U.S. A special counsel is investigating ties between Russia and the Trump campaign, and it's already exposed evidence that Russian intelligence operatives tampered with the U.S. election. Before the meeting, we turned to two people in Helsinki for analysis. Anton Troyanovsky is the Moscow bureau chief for The Washington Post, and Ambassador Michael McFaul, who served as U.S. ambassador to Russia from 2012 to 2014. Ambassador McFaul said that the ongoing Russia investigation means this summit is pretty extraordinary.
What I do find really strange with President Trump's approach is that he doesn't seem to be willing to press President Putin on that interference, that intervention in our presidential election in 2016, or anything for that matter. So sometimes summits are about pushing back on leaders. Most certainly it was during the Cold War. President Trump doesn't seem to want to do that.
Anton, what is the overall view of everything that's happening on the ground in Moscow?
Well, I've been struck. I mean, in terms of the overall view, I just got a note from my colleague who's back in Moscow that one commentator on Russian state television said just now, watching the start of the meeting between Putin and Trump, that Putin looks very relaxed while Trump looks concerned and nervous. And that has been the mood music in Moscow leading up to this. The other thing is that I've been struck by how much Trump's rhetoric here has really echoed what we've heard from the Russians leading up to this. It's been the idea that it's Obama's fault that relations between the U.S. and Russia are so bad. The idea that, you know, U.S. and Russia have to talk because they control 90% of the world's nuclear weapons. That's all stuff we've been hearing over and over in Moscow in the last months and years. And it is quite striking to hear those exact same arguments from the President of the United States now.
And of course, we just had news over the weekend that 12 Russian military intelligence officers were accused of hacking the Democratic National Committee. Anton, what's the reaction in Russia to the latest indictments here from Rod Rosenstein of the 12 Russian operatives?
You know, very predictably, it's also basically what we hear from Trump, which is that this is a last-ditch effort by the Washington establishment, by the American deep state, by the perpetrators of this witch hunt to stop Trump's long-held promise to improve ties between the U.S. and Russia. Obviously, the Russians very much paid attention to the U.S. presidential campaign. They paid attention every time that Trump said he wants to get along with Russia, and they've been impatient because, you know, Trump keeps saying it, but we've seen new sanctions in the past year. We've seen U.S. weapons deliveries to Ukraine. So the Russians are trying to figure out what exactly is U.S. policy toward Russia, and they hope that this meeting today in Helsinki will mark some kind of a new direction.
I'd actually like to pose the next question to both of you and ask whether or not this is really playing into what President Vladimir Putin has long wanted. And I'm thinking about the FBI agent Peter Strzok's testimony last week when he said that this is all just another notch on Putin's belt, that this infighting that's happening in the United States, the division that we're experiencing in this country is really just playing into what President Vladimir Putin wanted. Each of your thoughts on that.
Well, first, the president has been saying in the run-up to this meeting is just extraordinary. I want people to understand how extraordinary it is. One of his tweets was, America is to blame for all the tension in U.S.-Russian relations. The second thing, Anton said, you know, what the Russians like, they agreed with that. In fact, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs retweeted President Trump and said, we agree. Right. But never in their wildest dreams would they think that the president of the United States would call the European Union a foe of the United States. Not even the Russians would ever say that. Mm-hmm. So tragically, President Trump is offering everything that Vladimir Putin wants.
Anton, your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of what this means for Putin, I would add that Putin at home right now, despite the apparent success of the World Cup, actually has some problems. He is trying to raise the retirement age, and that has contributed to his approval rating among Russians dropping from 70% to 50%. So by 20 percentage points just in the last month or two. And, you know, this shows us that the rah-rah patriotism, nationalism that really carried Putin's popularity in the wake of the annexation of Crimea is starting to wear off. One of Putin's main selling points domestically is that he's restoring Russian prestige, that he's restoring kind of Soviet-era power that Moscow had on the world stage. And he needs that right now domestically. He needs to that message to be carried domestically. And what better way, of course, for Russian state TV to present that message than with today's dramatic pictures of this highly anticipated summit in Helsinki.
And of course, Ambassador, I'm just curious, two questions. What's the reaction in Washington been to this summit so far, if you have any sense of that? And also, wither the Democrats? Why so much silence from the Democrats on this? Why not more movement from them to be more vocal about what this could potentially mean?
Well, with respect to Washington and the Trump administration, I think most people in the Trump administration disagree with President Trump in terms of this rapprochement with Putin. It's very striking. The Trump administration has one policy towards Russia, and I think it's pretty good, by the way. There's a lot of continuity with the Obama administration in terms of containing Russia, pushing back on Putin. And in some ways, they've gone farther than President Obama went, providing lethal assistance, for instance, to Ukraine. The problem is their boss doesn't agree with them. And he's made that very clear that he doesn't agree with them. That when he says things like Russia should join the G7 again, or I just want a good relationship with Putin, most of his senior advisors, to the best of my knowledge, disagree with him on those statements. With respect to the Democrats, I think the Democrats have been pushing back. Many people called for the cancellation of this summit. You know, it's hard to control foreign policy when you neither control the Senate or the House. And I suspect that if this does become just a, you know, lavishing praise on President Putin, you'll hear from a lot of Democratic senators and a lot of Democratic hopefuls for 2020 that President Trump made a huge mistake.
Anton, your thoughts from Helsinki. What's the energy like there?
The city, the center, is very much shut down. Obviously, Finland is really pulling out all the stops here. Like I said, back in Russia, there also watching this very carefully. One interesting side note is that Putin today, for the first time, rode into a meeting on foreign soil on his brand new Russian-made limousine that is replacing the Mercedes he's been riding for a very long time. And that fact in itself is already getting big play in the Russian media, and that shows you how Putin is able to use these made-for-TV events like this summit to really push the idea again that he's restoring Russian prestige.
You mentioned made-for-TV. I mean, this is our president. President Trump has often been criticized for using the platform very much as a made-for-TV or slash reality TV event. Is that the sense that you're getting on the ground?
I mean, that is also absolutely Putin's MO. I would say the difference is that, I mean, Putin's power back in Russia is bound up in large part, at least as far as his popularity goes, in the fact that he controls the state TV channels. And if you look at the big events that Putin has had just in the last few months back in Russia, for instance, his inauguration or the opening of the bridge to Crimea, those have been such lavishly produced television events that, you know, you do think of Trump there. You do think of how both of these leaders, in very much their own ways, rely on TV to build their popularity.
And Ambassador, I just want to close with letting you hear a clip from over the weekend of Senator Rand Paul from CNN's State of the Union, where he talked about how all countries spy. And I'd like to get your thoughts on that.
I think really we mistake our response if we think it's about accountability from the Russians. They're another country. They're going to spy on us.
Ambassador, your thoughts. And that was, of course, in reaction to the news of the 12 Russian operatives.
Well, of course, all countries that have the capabilities to do so use intelligence, gather intelligence. That is true. What all countries don't do is use that intelligence that are stolen to then influence the outcome of elections. And I just find this moral equivalency that Senator Rand Paul was talking about to be categorically false. What Russia did in 2016 was unprecedented. It was deliberately designed to help one of our candidates. And I just wish more Americans would be more outraged by that. We should be able to choose our presidents without anybody putting their thumb on the scale, and especially not Vladimir Putin.
Anton Troyanovsky is the Moscow bureau chief for The Washington Post, and Ambassador Michael McFaul is the author of From Cold War to Hot Peace, An American Ambassador in Putin's Russia. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
During today's meeting, I addressed directly with President Putin the issue of Russian interference in our elections. I think that the probe is a disaster for our country. I think it's kept us apart.
With us for a reaction to that press conference is Anne Applebaum, a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, columnist for The Washington Post, and author most recently of Red Famine, Stalin's War on Ukraine. Anne, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And so we just watched what I would say was an absolutely stunning display of deference to Russia, who is considered a hostile power that's been accused of tampering in our election in the United States. Your immediate reaction to this press conference?
Shocked, but not surprised. Trump has, for quite a long time, been pushing back, resisting the idea of admitting that there was any Russian role in his election. He seems to see it as undermining his legitimacy. He more or less made that point during the press conference. And I also think that we've probably misinterpreted or guessed wrongly about how Trump would feel about the most recent Mueller indictment. Remember that the Mueller indictment showed in great detail, actually, using names and dates and so on, how a series of Russian intelligence officers had hacked into the Democratic National Committee, how they had stolen emails, how they had stolen data analytics and all kinds of other things. Trump may have understood this for the first time as, you know, real proof of exactly how much Putin helped him. And he is grateful. You know, Putin helped him become president. And he staged this very elaborate press conference to thank him. I mean, that's a more logical interpretation than any other.
I want to read you a tweet, since a lot of this activity is happening, unfortunately or fortunately, on Twitter, however you want to look at that, from former CIA Director John Brennan. And this was his tweet, and I'm quoting here: Donald Trump's press conference performance in Helsinki rises to and exceeds the threshold of, quote, high crimes and misdemeanors. It was nothing short of treasonous. Not only were Trump's comments imbecilic, he is wholly in the pocket of Putin. Republican patriots, where are you? And again, that was former CIA Director John Brennan's tweet. Your reaction to that?
I mean, you know, one has to be careful using language like treason because it has real legal implications. But yes, I think the tone of it, the tone of John Brennan's reaction, is understandable. I mean, look, this was an incredible scene. Remember what we just saw? We saw a U.S. president, first of all, attacking Democrats, attacking his political opponents on a stage, attacking the FBI by implication on a stage while standing next to the Russian president. You know, we saw him defer to the Russian president and defer to his interpretations of events. In other words, this is an American president attacking American institutions, while standing next to a country which, at the very least, is a rival and in many ways is an American enemy. And I don't think we've seen anything like that before. And people were reaching for all kinds of language and all kinds of metaphors and all kinds of comparison to find anything. Somebody pointed out, people talk about, you know, is this anything like appeasement, the British appeasement towards Hitler in the 1930s? Well, no, actually, it's a little worse than that, because Chamberlain, when he was an appeaser, wasn't complimenting Hitler or thanking him for intervening in British politics. So it's very hard to find any analogy that makes sense.
I also want to read another tweet from Dan Rather, the former network news broadcast journalist here, who said, and I quote, "American journalists have shown more bravery and honesty in questioning Putin about the Russian attack on American sovereignty than the president of the United States." We know that President Trump has had and continues to have a very difficult and contentious relationship with members of the media. He's continued that relationship while he was abroad in Europe at the end of last week. Your thoughts on that? I mean, is this a moment for American journalists to just say what they really think? Because I think that's what we're seeing a lot now, after both on Anderson Cooper. We're seeing that across social media.
Yes. Well, I mean, I'm always in favor of journalists saying what they really think and holding to some sort of weird, you know, pretensions of being you know, balancing different sides against one another when one is telling the truth and one is lying is something that I've never liked. The comments about the media, we didn't hear that today so much as we saw disrespect for the media, in that Trump didn't answer questions that were directed that were sent directly to him. He deferred them. He went around them. He didn't come up with he didn't attack journalists by name as he's done in the past, and he didn't use his expression fake news as he has in the past. But you're right, he did do that in Britain a couple of days ago. He gave an interview to a British tabloid. The tabloid ran the interview and then ran an audio of the interview. And then he denied saying what we could all hear him say. So this is, as I said, it's not really a question anymore of, you know, being against the media. This is somebody who doesn't acknowledge reality, you know, where who lives in a fantasy world. And we've all known that for a long time. But to see it repeated and displayed abroad while he's standing next to foreign leaders, while he's speaking for the United States around the world, is really embarrassing.
And there's another a couple more questions I have just about the whether or not this meeting, I mean, President Trump was putting this meeting forward as a way to mend, if you will, relations between Russia and the United States. But could this meeting have had the opposite effect that President Trump was looking for and actually be dangerous to American national security?
I think it could be dangerous to national security because, first of all, none of the details of the meeting have really come out yet. They had a 2-hour conversation. It was them one on one. There was nobody else present. We don't really know what was said yet. We don't know any of the details that were discussed in the larger meeting with
advisors. And we may never know, right? I mean, that's
we may
sort
never
of,
know. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We we may never know. We don't know what went down between them. And so in that sense, yes, there is a when you have a president who's clearly not acting in the interest of American national security, but is acting in his own personal interests, then you have to ask, what was going on? So that's one piece of it. I mean, the other piece of it is even the substantial pieces of their conversation, the hints that we had beforehand and some of the things that we know have been discussed in the White House are also very worrying. One plan that has been discussed, and I don't know, we don't know yet whether how much detail they went into in the meeting, was a plan, for example, to give control of Syria back to President Assad, who is Putin's ally. In other words, to let Assad overrun Syria, which he's beginning to do anyway, although there are still pockets of resistance, and then to do so in exchange for Putin somehow then keeping Iran out of Syrian politics, as if Putin had that ability. That's something that could really backfire on American security. It would create more refugees in Syria, more violence, and possibly therefore create more unrest in Europe as well.
Anne Applebaum is a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and a columnist for The Washington Post. Anne, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
What's your reaction to the summit and the press conference? Tell us what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. If you like what you're hearing, give us a rating and review us on iTunes. Also, tell your friends. Share this podcast on Facebook or Twitter or wherever you want your followers to get some solid news coverage. They'll be smarter. They'll think you're a hero. It's a win-win. All right, now back to the show.
Income inequality is rising quickly in Asian American communities in the United States. That's according to numbers from the Pew Research Center released last week. Although the overall gap between the rich and the poor has risen steadily in the United States since the 1970s, this new study shows that the gap between the rich and the poor in Asian communities has surpassed the gap in African American and Latino communities. To understand more about these findings, I spoke with Chaya Chaum. She's the executive director of Mekong New York City, a community-based organization serving the Cambodian and Vietnamese communities here in New York City. And to explain the report itself, we're also joined by Rakesh Kocher, senior researcher at the Pew Research Center in Washington, D.C.
Generally speaking, the approach we take presents a more nuanced picture of the diversity in economic outcomes both within groups and across groups in the United States. And one thing we learn is that no group is monolithic. So, for example, Asians are often pictured as the highest achieving group in America, but it is clear from our report that Asians, in fact, are the most economically divided or diverse group in America.
And can you give us some of the numbers? So what does that mean for people when you say that Asian Americans are the most economically divided group?
So what we do is we compare the incomes of Asians at the top of the income ladder or near the top and compare them to the incomes near the bottom of the income ladder among Asians. And we find that ratio is almost 11 times. That means people at the top are making almost 11 times as much as Asian Americans at the bottom of the income ladder. And that's a much higher ratio than among whites, for example, which is closer to 8.
And so is this essentially breaking the myth of the quote-unquote model minority? Because often when we talk about wealth and, which is different from income, as we've said many times on the show, when we talk about wealth and we talk about race, there are often people who will say, well, look at Asian Americans, they do really well, right? But when you're talking about separating the data and disaggregating the data, we're finding that that's not always the case.
Right. So our focus is not on aggregate comparisons that are often based on mean or median incomes. Now, it is true that on average or at the median, Asian Americans earn more than other major racial or ethnic groups in the U.S. But when you break apart the data and look at people at all strata in the income distribution, we find that, in fact, lower income Asians lag behind some other groups. And it's not necessarily true that they're all high achieving.
And Chaya, I'm wondering, when you heard about the findings from Pew, were you surprised?
Absolutely not. It really reaffirms the experiences of a lot of Southeast Asians. And I speak particularly about Southeast Asians in the Bronx who were inserted into urban poverty in the 1980s, right after the Vietnam War. and inserted into essentially urban poverty and refugee poverty. And it really speaks to the existence and the narrative of the Southeast Asian community who's been invisible for so long, particularly in New York City and the Bronx, but also we are essentially the myth, the minority myth.
And where does that myth essentially come from? I mean, why do we focus so much on that narrative?
I think that the mainstream media does that. You know, I think this is, we live in a country who historically pits other communities together, framing Asians as the ideal minority and essentially saying that other people of color are less than and that, you know, Asians are doing better and things like that. But what it does, it creates such a blanket and it's such a state of invisibility for our community, you know. And yes, you know, without data aggregation, it doesn't talk about the needs of mental health services in a highly traumatized community such as the Cambodians throughout New York City, but throughout the nation. Doesn't give us resources, the kind of funding and the kind of programs that our community needs, particularly our elders. And one of the things that is challenging for us as a community-based organization now is like the elders in our community, the Vietnamese and Cambodian elders, are, you know, no longer can afford living in their one-bedroom apartment because they live on public assistance and food stamps, and there's no other programs that can support them because their data doesn't even exist in New York City. So this report really confirms the experiences of many Southeast Asians, particularly living in New York City and the Bronx and other urban communities throughout the country, and makes it visible.
And what are some of the signs of inequality among Asian Americans in the Bronx, as you mentioned, and outside of the Bronx that do you see here in New York?
Southeast Asians have had one of the highest high school dropout rate, one of the lowest attainment in higher education, one of the highest mental health, PTSD, depression. So you have communities in struggles that are not being funded or supported by government institutions or even other institutions that provide resources, the kind of resources that allow folks to thrive and live in healthy communities.
What can policymakers do better? And this is a question for both of you, in terms of addressing not just the awareness that Asian Americans, some Asian American groups live in poverty, but also moving those groups along so that they can get out of poverty.
One thing we learned from disaggregating inequality or income or any comparison, disaggregating it further across the entire strata of the income distribution, is that we learn more about the causes and consequences of inequality. I hope those are informative to the policymakers, but I don't have any prescriptions.
I agree. We're going to definitely use this to continue to advocate for resources and fundings from the city, from the state, from the federal government to support programs and community-based organizations to do the work of serving the people. But also, you know, we have a history of racism in this country that makes discrimination and this inequality huge. And I know that for us, when we fight for and advocate for Southeast Asian, we're also advocating for systemic change that challenges racism in this country that has historically kept communities poor in the ghettos. So these kinds of findings are tools that we can use to advocate and mobilize our community around to participate in civic engagement, community organizing, but more specifically to get more resources into the community-based organization that are doing the work to support and provide services for these communities.
Rakesh Kochhar is a senior researcher at the Pew Research Center, joining us from Washington, D.C., and Chaya Chaum is the director of the Mekong New York City community-based organization serving Cambodians and Vietnamese communities here in New York City. Thank you both for joining us today.
A pleasure.
Thank you.
Mama! Ma, perdóname. Salí a defender mi patria. Te amo, ¿viste?
Corriendo hacia el camión que nos iba a sacar de aquí y me dieron en la pierna.
A 15-hour siege left two students dead and at least 10 injured at the National Autonomous University of Nicaragua. Since April, students have been protesting President Daniel Ortega and his consolidation of power. According to a report by the Organization of American States, at least 273 people have died and 2,000 have been injured since the unrest began. In this weekend's protest, students took siege in a church, but that didn't stop government forces from shooting at them. Joshua Partlow is the Washington Post Mexico City bureau chief, and he was there during the siege. And what he saw, he'll tell us right now. Joshua, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So let's take a step back. Explain to our listeners why have these protests been going on since April?
There are a lot of reasons. It's something that's been building in Nicaragua for a long time. The president, Daniel Ortega, is now in his fourth term as president. It's widely agreed there that he's undermined democratic institutions in a number of ways. The Congress, the Supreme Court, answer to him, essentially. The spark that set off the protests in April was a rise in the Social Security payments that people had to make and a reduction in what they would get when they retired. And there were some videos of old people protesting that and then getting beaten by police. And that really enraged a lot of people. There were mass protests in lots of different parts of Nicaragua, including the capital, Managua, and the police started repressing those protests quite violently, and a lot of people got killed, and then it just spiraled from there.
And of course, you were there on the front lines, if you will, during the siege in this church. Is that not right?
Yeah, that's correct. I showed up on Friday afternoon. There was these paramilitary forces, which are essentially gunmen in civilian clothes who were working with the police. They were shooting at the National Autonomous University of Nicaragua and the students who had barricaded themselves inside. The students had taken over the university about 2 months ago, and the government and the paramilitary forces have been going around trying to break these barricaded, protested areas all over the country. In the last couple of weeks, there have been really bloody battles in different parts of Nicaragua, and then this was Friday's mission was essentially to recapture the university. So there was a church, a small Catholic church called the Church of the Divine Mercy, which is on the edge of the university. And students who were wounded were basically using that as an area to take refuge. And so as the gun battle continued, the students were retreating from the barricades they had lost from these paramilitaries and were convening at the church. And I was there doing interviews with these wounded students, at which point the paramilitaries basically closed off our exit, blocked the road, the only road out, and then we were all stuck in the church, essentially.
Now, you were able to escape. Can you tell us a little bit about how you were able to do that?
Yeah, we were there for about, it must have been four or five hours, I would say. We were closed in at about 6 p.m., and I was able to get out at about 10:30 p.m. There was shooting at the church throughout pretty much that entire time. I was able to get out because the Catholic Church and the U.S. Embassy was negotiating with the Nicaraguan government to try to stop the shooting, basically, to try to get ambulances in because there were wounded people in the church, and they were not letting ambulances get in to take them out. And also the American embassy was one of the things they were after was that there was an American citizen in there. So they wanted to get me out. So yeah, so they arranged a deal where they would let the ambulances go in and then they would take me out past the police lines. And that happened at about 10:30.
At the beginning of this segment, I read out a couple of numbers, 273 people who have died so far and 2,000 who've been injured. Do your numbers sort of line up with that? Are those about right in terms of as long as this has been going on?
Those are about right, but people also frequently cite more than 300, 350 dead at this point. Just yesterday, there were 10 more people at least killed in the town of Messiah, which is another place where the protests have been very active. And these, again, the same situation. The paramilitaries came in and sealed off the area and were fighting and shooting at people.
Are these organized protests too, Joshua? I'm just wondering, are these protests that are just sort of, you know, student driven, or have they really become much more organized? And is there a certain group or backing these protesters?
That's a good question. It's far beyond students at this point. It's wide sections of the population. A lot of the business leaders that were once backing President Ortega have switched sides and are now backing the protesters. When people say protesters, what it looks like is people who have, for example, in the town of Masaya, they declared themselves independent of the government. They put up roadblocks and with bricks and sticks and logs and tried to not let the police in. They threw the police out of the town, and they were essentially governing themselves. So they're in pretty much open revolt. It's not like a protest march down the street. It's areas that are saying they're no longer part of the government.
And are you expecting to see more of this as the weeks unfold?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think what we've seen in the last couple weeks is that the Nicaraguan government has taken back a lot of the areas that had declared themselves in protests and has successfully recaptured them. A lot of these towns, paramilitaries in convoys of pickup trucks are patrolling. But I have no doubt that the protests will continue and people will try to rebel in other ways.
Joshua Partlow is the Mexico City bureau chief for The Washington Post. Joshua, thanks for joining us and stay safe out there.
Thanks very much.
This week on The Takeaway, we're looking at food in the United States, specifically how our attitudes about food have changed over time in this country. One piece of that story came 25 years ago with the creation of the Food Network.
Bam! That's a little bam right there.
A little salt and pepper, and that's going to slide right out.
Happiness is a sharp knife.
For the first course, you had to find a way to combine catfish, tomatillos, rutabagas, and marshmallows.
There's one more ingredient to this battle. Our secret ingredient.
It's a crepe challenge, and his crepe was just superior.
So how has the Food Network affected our relationship with food? We'll go way back to the start for that answer with the help of Kara Miller, host of WGBH and PRI's Innovation Hub.
So you kind of have to go back to the early 1990s, and people who worked in cable at that time, and cable was still a pretty young industry in the early 90s, they understood that even though at that time there were just a few dozen channels, it was about to explode. There was going to be hundreds of channels. That was coming down the road. And so it was a gold mine, right? They were trying to think, what could you possibly put on television? Because you were going to be able to put it all on television. And there was a man named Ree Schoenfeld who had helped launch a little channel, you've probably heard of it, called CNN. And he decided maybe he could also help launch a food-themed channel. Now, the great irony of this is that Schoenfeld knew nothing about cooking, and he and his wife had actually had their kitchen removed from their New York City apartment because they figured, well, they live in New York.
That's pretty hardcore. That's a really hardcore move there.
I think they just had a coffee maker and like a place for dog food, and that was it. But he did also realize that there was one very compelling argument for like having a channel that was all about food. Here's journalist Alan Salkin, who has chronicled the rise of the Food Network.
The argument for a Food Network was that it was cheap. That is really as simple as you can get. It was programming you could put on the air 24/7 that wouldn't cost very much. Therefore, if you just sold a few ads, you could go into profit.
And so before the Food Network went on the air, did people in the food world or in the TV world think that this was going to succeed?
You know, Alan Salkin actually says that though there were arguments for the Food Network, the arguments against it were probably more solid at the time. So there were cooking programs already. They were on PBS, most famously Julia Child, right, had hosted a bunch of cooking programs. But there were other people like Martin Yan, who hosted a program called Yan Can Cook.
I remember
PBS.
Yan Can Cook. Yeah,
exactly. I watched that too. These were successful shows, but they were not huge money makers. So a lot of people thought the idea of having a 24-hour Food Network was craziness. And I talked to a former assistant of Julia Child, Sarah Moulton, who actually then went on to become an on-air personality on the Food Network for just about 10 years. And I asked her, you know, when executives took you out to lunch in New York in the early 1990s and said, do you want to be a part of this network? Like, what did you think? Did you think, this is going to succeed? This is going to make me famous?
Never in a million years, ever. I thought the network wouldn't last. And when I first did it, I said to my producer, when I first had my live call-in show, I was like, well, let's just, you know, do 3-month contract at a time because I'm just not sure how this is going to work. No, I didn't think it was going to last.
in the beginning, and Sarah Moulton will say this, anybody who you talk to who is on the Food Network will say this, this was a shoestring operation. They would start rolling tape, and if somebody cut him or herself, they would often keep rolling, and the person would have to bandage themselves on television. So this was, they didn't have a whole lot of money in the beginning. But Sarah Moulton said that very quickly, she felt like, I'm being recognized everywhere. She started to wonder, should I wear makeup all the time? Like, even when I go out to get, you know, coffee in the morning, because people were always looking at her. And then I think there were a couple of sort of big inflection points for the Food Network. And one was actually right after the attacks of September 11, 2001. And the Food Network, people might remember, they went off the air for a while. They didn't really know what to do. This actually happened to a bunch of cable channels. They just didn't know when they should return to regular programming. And the clamor that came in from viewers, please, please put cooking back on the air, was really quite incredible. And they realized that a lot of people turned to this network for comfort. And then another inflection point, very different, happened a few years later. And it was a new program that the Food Network aired from another country. It was called Iron Chef. It was from Japan. It was dubbed into English. And it just became, it was kind of a crazy show, and it became this huge breakthrough hit. And then Iron Chef Japan had the American chef, Bobby Flay, come on, and that just, like, totally captivated Americans. And I think that started Food Network down a bit of a different path.
Well, and that's where my interest comes into food programming. I love the competitive cooking element of these shows. Is competitive cooking really, was that a critical part of the rise of Americans watching food programming?
Certainly the success of Iron Chef pushed Food Network to have lots more cooking shows, Chopped and Cupcake Wars and all these things. And they all, if you think about it, have this kind of reality TV dimension to them in that, you know, people are eliminated, not unlike Survivor or The Bachelor. They have these kind of behind the scenes or like straight to the camera interviews with people. But I think it another aspect of this is that it also kind of affected the culture around food. So people, on the one hand, became aware of more unusual techniques, more unusual ingredients, and in some ways turning food into a competition with all these kind of, you know, this fancy ingredients and these things you've never seen, it can make you feel like this is super fun to watch, but it is not necessarily doable at home. And we heard from Alan Salkin earlier, who has written about the rise of the Food Network. He says, you know, obviously the Food Network has not made people stop cooking, but that doesn't mean it hasn't had an effect.
Now, the televisions are so big that it almost looks like you're looking at your own kitchen. It's high def. It's like a window, except the kitchen is probably neater than your own kitchen, more updated, and the person cooking is probably more beautiful than the person cooking in your own kitchen. And the food that's being produced is probably more beautiful than anything you can imagine producing.
I love that description of like sitting in your easy chair and being like, yeah, that what I see on television looks good, but I'm not quite so sure that I'm ready to do this at home. And it has coincided, the rise of the Food Network, with this sort of fascinating phenomenon, which is the decline of actual cooking in America.
And we'll talk about that later this week. Kara Miller is the host of the radio program Innovation Hub from our partner station, WGBH in Boston. Thanks so much for being here, Kara.
Thank you.
All this week, we're talking about Americans' relationship to food. And to kick things off, we want to know, how often do you cook meals at home? Do you find joy in cooking, or do you think of it as a chore?
Hi, my name is Frances. I'm saying chore, chore, chore. I certainly cook dinner every night as a young woman and young wife and mother. But now I'm a widow and I'm free, free, free.
As a regional truck driver, staying healthy is very important. So I try to cook all of my meals at home for at least 5 days on the road. That's 3 meals a day and snacks. Not only does it help me save money, but it helps me maintain my health. I think cooking is a very necessary survival skill that many young people my age are losing today.
This is Marcia Cutting from Bainbridge Island, Washington. I cook nearly all my meals at home unless I'm dining with friends. I'm not sure I'd say I find joy in cooking, though I enjoy it, unless I'm really rushed. The high amount of fat in most restaurant foods does not agree with my stomach, unfortunately.
I have a house full of picky eaters, and it's a pain to get people to agree on food, but I like to eat, and I enjoy cooking.
the complications have just made it less enjoyable. I do cook a big meal once a week on Sunday dinner, and our other kids come over, and we enjoy the get-together and dinner. It's a nice meal, and there are leftovers.
I am looking forward to my husband taking over the chore of meal prep once he retires.
Do you cook as much as you would like, or do you cook more often than you'd like? Why? We want to hear from you. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and we just might include your response on the show this week. Again, 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.